So just before we begin, any questions that you don't want to answer, just feel free to say. I don't want to answer that. Well, this is your story.
I'll tell you that I'm a very candid individual, so it would have to be something very, very challenging to make me scared to answer. But because I believe this could help other people, right, I'm going to work hard to, you know, allay those fears that might arise.
Sure. Well, I just appreciate you sharing your story, and it's about humanizing this issue and, you know, showing the caustic effects of incarceration on real lives, real people, right?
You're welcome.
So can you describe your confinement while housed in a Texas state jail or prison?
Okay. I've been to several state prisons. I'll tell you one of the first things that comes to my mind. And you really can't talk about prison without talking about the county jails. Mm. So I think I really need to start there.
Okay.
My county jail experience leading up to my state prison, and I have been in federal prison as well, essentially was horrible on multiple levels. Mind you, this was 1991, and I was in Taylor County, Texas. And we had a very draconian model of governing that facility. It was brute force. You know, the guards were brutal. We were brutal towards one another. I participated in that kind of brutality. I was a young man, angry. And I didn't really understand what I was contributing to, but I was contributing to a cycle of chaos for a lot of folk. One thing that stands out particularly about this county jail was that they would put the most aggressive people in one tank. All of the people that would be inclined towards fighting, we would be stuffed into one tank called 13. If we got out of hand, we would be hosed down with water. We'd be put into another tank, stripped, and be hosed down with water. This, of course, created angst between us and the guards. And if any one individual caused our circumstance to turn for the worse and caused the police or the COs to put attention on us, you know, that individual would probably be handled with aggression and force, violence.
Right.
So our food wasn't safe. We had to worry about they would put our food on the table. They would rack us on one side, put all the trays on the table, then open up the gate, and the guy who was the strongest would grab whatever plate he wanted to take. And if somebody came out there last and there wasn't a plate, he had to go lay back down on his bunk without any food, or he would have to stand up and fight. Now, things have changed since that time, and so I'm grateful that that kind of brutality is not just tolerated, because at that time it was tolerated.
Right.
But still, there's a problem today, because when the last time I've been to the county jail, they have these restraint seats where if you act out, if you're a mental health patient and you act out in some way that they deem inappropriate, and you don't even have to necessarily be violent, if you just create the impression that you're not complying, you can be stripped naked, put into a restraining chair with your arms locked into position and a bag placed over your head like you were some raving dog. And so rabid dog. Right. And so this is unacceptable. I mean, in a society that purports itself to be civilized, that purports itself to be advanced in its ideals, people need to know that this is happening. So here was, I endured that for almost a year. I was then remanded to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Well, what do you think my attitude is going to be like after I leave this brutal environment? I'm going to be angry. I'm going to be on guard.
And this is a state jail, right?
This was state prison.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it was preceding that was the county jail.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I go into the state. The next place I was sent to was... can I say names of institutions?
Mm-hmm, sure.
I was sent to Middleton. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I remember about this was when I first got off the bus and we were taken into this warehouse, if you will, they lined us up on the wall, stripped us naked, told us to put our hands up against the wall, and about five guards walked up and down behind us, screaming and shouting and yelling and degrading us and telling us that we were no longer in control. Mm-hmm. I realized now they were trying to break us. I realize now that they were trying to instill fear in us. And I realize now that they were dehumanizing us by stripping us naked, having us stand close to one another, Mm-hmm. And then, you know, displaying their power and highlighting our weakness. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know how to respond to that other than by complying. Mm-hmm. But as years would go by, I would realize that this was a head game that I was being subjected to, that they were very much getting in my head, or work trying to get in my head, to create conformity,
right,
for the purposes of their, you know, being able to manage the facility. And of course, you know, we want prisons to be places where people are safe, but I don't think, you know, berating us and degrading us is safe. So that's one thing I want to highlight. Another experience that vividly stands out to me is that in the summer times, TDCJ can be very hot.
Drop like flies in there.
Yeah, hot. Ooh. And,
or cold.
You know, we don't have, you know, if you have a fan, if you have the luxury of affording a $25 fan, which is almost the equivalency of probably $100 in the free society, if not more to us in prison, when you have nobody sending you any money.
Right.
It's still not enough. So you live on these farms, as they call them, mm-hmm. And they're made out of tin, mm-hmm. and the sun is beating down on these tin walls, and it's just generating massive amounts of heat. We don't go outside very often. And so we're all in this dorm.
Plus the body heat.
Plus the body heat. So it's a recipe for anger,
yeah,
and frustration. Yeah. And so a lot of fights transpire. The only one of the ways that we, you know, try to respond to this is by getting a sheet, going into the shower, soaking the sheet, and wrapping around us to stay cool. That's our air condition. Mm-hmm. But that's archaic.
Yeah.
And so I believe that folk, again, need to know about these conditions. Because, you know, how do you expect someone to exist under these circumstances for years on end, come home, and thrive? Mm-hmm. They're going to be angry, they're going to be resentful, and they're going to be paranoid, because they're not going to trust anyone related to the system that puts their hand out saying, I'm here to help you, because you've never seemed to help me before.
Mm-hmm.
If I could give another example, and I'll make this my last example about what things were like. One of the things, this is really intangible in the sense that it's not a condition of the place,
mm-hmm.
but it's a state that comes from being in that place, and it's the loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're around people all the time, I don't know anybody here.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Unless somebody is there from my hometown, and even if they're from my hometown, if I didn't know him when I was out there, I don't know what he's going to be like inside here. So I don't know if I can trust this guy to be my companion.
Right.
To come close to me.
Mm-hmm.
This person may have ulterior motives. This person may not be stable. This person may be a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want just somebody, because I'd be from the same hometown,
mm-hmm.
to be my companion. So, you know, a lot of times in order to survive, we have to maintain our loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very difficult place to be in, because, I mean, we need companionship. We need people in our lives. And so here we have this need, but we have a circumstance that doesn't foster,
right,
openness, mm-hmm. closeness with others, because we're afraid that, you know, we might be exploited or taken advantage of. So
right.
we have to continuously walk around with this mask on our face to deflect any potential attackers, or, you know, that might think we can be their victim.
Right.
So that's something that I feel is important to mention. Having people from the outside come into the prisons who create relationships that obviously are kind people that have compassion for us, having those people come into our prisons is absolutely invaluable, because they create space for us to explore our humanity.
Right. Mm-hmm. Gives you hope.
Yes, it does. Although I would want to mention one caveat. You know, the sad part about it is a lot of times, and the only outlet for that kind of interaction is through religious services, and everybody in prison is not necessarily inclined to religious services.
Right.
So we need to create space in these institutions for people that are not really affiliated with religion to be a part of giving to,
right,
and sharing with this population.
Right. Right. I love that. And did you ever feel unsafe inside there? And if so, how?
That's a no-brainer. I mean, you get up to go to breakfast in the morning, and all you want to do is eat your oatmeal.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting there at your table, and you're preparing to enjoy this bland oatmeal that's not much water in it, very little sugar.
That's all you got.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you hear plates being thrown, scuffled. And next thing you know, you got tear gas in your mouth instead of oatmeal. Mm-hmm. So even though I've not served time on some of, quote unquote, Texas's most violent prisons, or they call them rock and roll farms or gladiator farms, it didn't matter. Every day, there was the shadow of violence, or the potential for violence, that lingered. Mm-hmm. Because you don't know what's going to happen. You're surrounded by folk that don't necessarily know how to control their anger, may not necessarily care to control their anger because they're angry.
Right.
We're compacted close together, mm-hmm. which is a rest. We shower together. We use a restroom in the open.
Right.
It doesn't foster peace. It's an environment that by its very nature spawns this hostility. I got to use the restroom, but I have to be seen by other men.
Right.
That is not, it's early in the morning. I just want to brush my teeth, but now I've got to listen to a man hock spitting in the sink.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not a morning person.
Right.
Thankfully, I don't respond with violence, but maybe the next guy is not really ready to hear somebody passing gas right next to him right. in the bathroom. And so he hauls off and hits this guy.
Right.
Or it may be that we're going to breakfast and the guy is slow to wake, and so he misses the breakfast call. So he's on the door screaming and shouting that he missed breakfast, and he's demanding that they open the door, and they're not opening the door. And they say, get off the button, and he doesn't get off the button. So they call the goon squad, and now you got to witness this in the morning. And so did I ever feel unsafe? Absolutely. I mean, I didn't necessarily walk around every day in total fear and anxiety, but I was keen to my environment. I knew that at any moment my behavior could trigger something. Yeah. So, like, for example, I went to lunch one day with a friend of mine that I had made friends with, and he was coming to sit down with me. There was a chair open next to me. And as he sat down, he didn't notice there was a hat in the chair. So it was a gentleman's hat. The guy reached out and, you know, kind of stiff-armed him to make sure he wouldn't sit on his hat. His knee-jerk reaction was to mouth off back at him. This guy takes offense at it, leaves, walks out. We don't know what's going on. We get out and we see three Mexicans coming towards us. But they noticed me with him, and because I had a religious affiliation and because I was a leader and because I had some respect, they backed off. But they said it was only because of me. Mm-hmm. But that day, somebody could have died
right.
over a hat.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. one was black and one was Mexican.
Right.
So the point I bring up in prison, just by my very nature, the very nature of my identity or our identities or the groups that we align ourselves with by default, there's an underlying racial current that creates the recipe for violence at any given moment. We have showers that are designated Mexican showers, black showers. Y'all can't shower on this side. You know, whites don't mix with the blacks. Blacks don't mix with the whites. The whites and the Mexicans get along. The blacks and the Mexicans don't get along. Okay. And if anybody from any group crosses the line, they risk, retaliation. So there's definitely a shadow of violence that constantly lingers in that space. So yes, that is true for me, that there were times that I felt unsafe.
Sure. And how has your experiences with state jail affected your life, maybe your loved ones, your ability to find viable employment, housing, or any other insights you're willing to share?
I read a term many years ago called post-conviction penalties. And I now know totally what that means, because after being out of prison for 13 years, my first experience was trying to get an apartment. Mm-hmm. I was so giddy that I had finally saved up enough money after turning on the water, turning on the lights and the gas to an apartment that I was fortunate enough to be able to parole to with my brother, who was a mental health patient. Mm-hmm. But he had no water, no lights, and no gas. finally we turn it on and I save my nickels and dimes because I want my own space. My brother's using it. I'm not going to be in a safe environment if I stay here with him. And sure. I love him, but I can't die.
Right.
Unfortunately, he's now passed away from an overdose.
I'm sorry.
May he rest in
that.
Peace. Thank you for your sympathies.
Yeah.
Well, I got my money saved up and I'm well aware that it could be problematic. I just didn't know how much it would be problematic. So I go out and I get my application and I say, well, look, I want to be honest with you, ma'am. I could very well, if you're going to do a background check, I want you to know I have a felony conviction. Mm-hmm. Oh, we are very tolerant. You know, we understand, but we know this is part of the process. So we need you to go ahead and just fill out this application. It's a $50 fee. We'll have an answer to you probably by tomorrow. And just hold tight. We'll get back with you. 2 days later, I call. Hello, ma'am. Oh, yes. You were denied.
And we got your $50.
And we've got your $50. So I've done that now 4 times. And each time I told you I had a felony background.
Right.
Why don't you just be honest with me and tell me you're going to be denied here. So don't waste your time.
Save you the money that you worked so hard for.
But they didn't want to save me the money because I was easy prey. Mm-hmm. So here I was now saving my nickels and dimes together.
Right.
And being victimized.
Right.
For what little I had.
Mm-hmm.
That was disheartening.
Yeah.
That was enough. Thank God I had some people in my life that I could talk to about my feelings. But it's those kind of feelings that cause us despair, that cause us to go right back to using drugs and alcohol.
Right.
Now, that may not sound logical to the next person, but it makes great sense to us who have felt rejected by society for so long.
Right. Right.
I agree. That was an experience that I've not wanted to revisit.
Right.
So I'm very cautious about how I pursue seeking housing.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes we have to lie.
Right.
Or we have to find alternative. We have to get somebody else to get the apartment in their name.
Right.
But now they run the risk because if we don't do something wrong, they're liable. And who, you know, so you have to have somebody that trusts you a great deal that says, I'm willing to put my name on your lease. But now we're living in a place where we can't go interact with the landlord.
Right.
So we have to hide at our own place of residence.
That you're paying for.
That we're paying for. We have to be afraid when somebody knocks on the door. Oh, I can't let them see me here. Hide our clothes if somebody comes over to visit. Pretend like somebody else lives here. But I'm paying the rent.
Right.
Or live with somebody else and run the risk of being told, I'm sorry, but you've got to get out.
Get out, right. Mm-hmm.
So that has
stressful.
Been a challenge for me. And at times I found myself living out of a car.
Mm-hmm.
At times I found myself living at the Salvation Army. At times I found myself living in shelters. At times I found myself trying to get a rest at a park.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had no place else to live. Now, mind you, some of that was also the result of using, but these using bouts came about because of the stress of some of the things that I'm describing now.
Sure.
And i.e. housing is on the top of that list. Secondly, I would say getting a job. How much I've dreaded over the years going to an employer and looking at that application, even before I looked at the application, thinking to myself, Lord, have mercy. They're going to ask me whether or not I've been convicted of a felony.
Right.
And the feeling that comes with that part that when you know they're going to go do that background check and you're like, well, what's going to come back? It's like waiting for your HIV results.
Right.
And you know you've been sleeping with multiple partners and you're like, okay, there's a risk here.
Right.
So you know there's fear, there's anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And so for however many days I've got to wait for that answer to come back, I'm waiting and I'm anxious and I'm waiting and I'm fearful and I'm waiting and I'm sitting on these emotions that are like toxins in my blood, eating away at my peace. So those are some of the ways that come to my mind when we think about difficulties. Another difficulty reality is, for me, I'm going to be honest and say relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, prison for men is prison for men. And, you know, you don't learn how to be in a relationship with another man.
Right.
In relationship with them. We can form relationships and bonds in there. Sometimes, you know, they are intimate relationships that occur and sometimes they're not. Most times they're not. But whatever the case may be, we can't learn how to be a father,
right,
or a husband, or a good partner when we're dealing with the egos and the challenges that, that come with living for 15 years, 10 years, 5 years, 3 years mm-hmm. with other men.
Right.
So coming home and establishing a healthy relationship for me has been problematic.
Yeah.
I realize that there are a lot of underlying issues that I've got to get resolved. Mm-hmm. And when I was incarcerated, I didn't have the supports. I didn't even know that these things existed. I didn't know until I came home. And so I believe firmly that we have to have, you know, people and resources available to us specifically for these kinds of needs when we return home.
Criminally justice involved. Yeah. Peer support.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
So.
Sure.
I'll yield and stop there, but mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are other examples that I can come up with.
Did you utilize or were you referred to any community-based support outside of the criminal justice system before or after your incarceration?
Oh, absolutely. Now, I personally was determined to figure out a way. I had been in prison going back to when I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you get to asking yourself the question, are you going to be able to not do this again? Mm-hmm. Are you going to be able to sustain your freedom over the course of time?
Right.
And that was a language I learned from a program I had entered into where they told you to ask yourself this question. Is this behavior going to produce this result over the course of time? So,
right.
You know, for me, I wanted my freedom to last over the course of time.
Right.
So what I started doing before getting out was writing to folk. If I would read a book and that book would inspire me in some way and I felt that they were accessible, mm-hmm. I'd write to them. That started that way. If I heard about an organization, I actually wrote to you guys,
mm-hmm.
The Criminal Justice Coalition, when I was incarcerated, asking for some testimony that they had given because I wanted to share that with other people.
Right.
But I wrote to the loved ones of prisoners. Mm-hmm. I wrote to TIFA. I wrote to the NAACP, but mm-hmm. not very much to them because I didn't really know how, and their presence on the field of, you know, addressing the needs of the incarcerated mm-hmm. wasn't very clear when I was incarcerated.
Yeah.
But I wrote to anybody and everyone I could. Churches.
Were any of those organizations helpful or not helpful?
While I was incarcerated, they weren't very helpful,
right.
Other than they'd be able to respond with a letter saying, you know, thank you so much for, you know, you're reaching out to us. We right. want to encourage you to continue to maintain the course you're on. Right. Some folks said that when you got out, if you visited with us, we'd be more than willing. The only group that I remember clearly in any way demonstrating some willingness to be a channel for me was Loops, Loved Ones of Prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
But they, when I got to their meeting, it was filled with a room full of old white women. They were very kind. They were very kind and compassionate. They were very kind and compassionate, but I was a black man walking through this door. I wasn't afraid of them, and I hope they weren't afraid of me, and I don't think they were. But I was sitting there thinking to myself, what can you all do for me? And the only thing that they were prepared to do was pray with me.
Right.
And I was like, well, thank you, and I'll receive that.
Right.
But I need transportation.
I need
housing. You know, and you know, some of them were willing to, you know, assist me with things like accessing some food, right. stuffs. But I was like, I thought this was going to be more than what it is.
Right.
It wasn't more than that. It was women who had been impacted by the system.
Right.
That were trying to hold on to their hope for their loved ones.
Right.
And they cared about people like me enough to write a letter.
That means a lot, though.
And it did. It did. It touched me so deeply. It touched me so deeply.
I read that thing over and over.
Mm-hmm. It touched me so deeply that I determined that I would go visit with them and establish a relationship with them because I felt their love.
Right.
But they weren't equipped to handle the complexities of my needs.
Right.
And so as much as I empathize with their cause, I couldn't rely on them for the supports that I needed.
Right.
I didn't know how to use them any better than what they were offering to help me with at the time. So I had to seek help elsewhere. I learned about a woman who was with another organization called the Winner's Circle. Mm-hmm. And Deborah Jo was her name, She was a long-time methamphetamine user, a white woman, But she, contrary to these other women, had experience with the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And she was a counselor for drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. And she was outspoken about her experience with incarceration. Mm-hmm. And she belonged to this group that facilitated a discussion for those of us coming home from prison to talk about the trauma of being incarcerated and mm-hmm. our struggles with substances.
Right.
So I was like, okay, wow, this is interesting. However, mm-hmm. the caveat to that is that when I joined on with them, mind you, I was in West Texas when I came home from prison. West Texas is not Austin.
Right.
So there was not a lot of diversity. So again, I was primarily in a room full of whites and Hispanics, mm-hmm. probably one of the only African Americans involved. Mm-hmm. And when I would try to discuss issues that related to my cultural needs,
right.
they weren't very open to that.
It wasn't there, yeah.
No. And they couldn't support me in my quest. Mm-hmm. So I had to ultimately find some other supports. But mm-hmm. but I searched high and low. I'll tell you one organization that did benefit me significantly. And it didn't outwardly manifest itself as a resource for formerly incarcerated. I learned about this concept called individual development accounts when I was incarcerated. It was a federal program that's available through agencies in various locations. One organization in my community was called CAP, Community Action Program. Mm-hmm. I went there for another reason. I met a gentleman who worked there, and I was doing some speaking at a local recreation center, and because I needed to visit with him, he worked at that office. I had to go into the office. And when I went into the office, I saw a pamphlet that talked about the very thing I had read about when I was incarcerated. So I picked up the pamphlet. Mm-hmm. And then I asked the receptionist, how do you get involved with this? She said, well, you have to apply for a case manager. And that right there turned the tide for me. Mm-hmm. Because having somebody to check in with every 2 weeks about my goals.
Your progress.
How my progress and how mm-hmm. I was faring. It gave me motivation. It gave me a sense of accountability and some partnership.
Right.
And it was like, wow, somebody's walking with me through this. This woman didn't know anything about imprisonment, but she was kind, she was a good listener, and she was willing to help me navigate the many goals that I had written down from my lofty ideas about what would happen when I got released. But getting those things done, I wasn't always keen to how to do, and she would point me in the right direction.
Right.
Well, you talk about you want to start a business, Robert. This is where you go to get a business license. Right. This is what you have to do. This is what you have to do to get your tax ID number. Mm-hmm. And I would run off and do that. Now I know the process. Now I can share that with somebody else.
Right.
So
love it.
I'll yield there.
Okay. And so did you ever reenter the prison system at any point?
Yes. 6 months or so after I was released from my last 4.5 year sentence, mm-hmm. I relapsed. Mm-hmm. And I was remanded to the county jail mm-hmm. for a parole hearing. And in that process, it was recommended that I not be revoked, but that I be remanded to the intermediate sanction facility. Mm-hmm. I call it the purgatory of prison. You're not quite in heaven, and you definitely ain't in hell, but you're somewhere in between. So yeah. I went there for 3 weeks and almost starved to death because everybody was stealing the food from the kitchen. So when you went to the kitchen, there would be very little foods left. And, you know, we had rations. We weren't eating very well. But that said, I'm grateful that I didn't go back to prison. It was called a graded sanction. And it was an opportunity for me to recalibrate what had gone wrong. I had just gotten out after 4.5 years on a 12-year sentence. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there thinking to myself, Robert, you said you didn't want this to happen.
Right.
So I had a little time to think, mm-hmm. what do I want to do? Do I really want to go back to using drugs and let this happen again? Mm-hmm. So I made up my mind that I was going to return to that person that I had created when I was in prison, mm-hmm. that said he wanted life and life more abundantly.
Right.
And so I got out and I went and by the grace of God, my duffel bag with all of my prison writings and all of my notes and all of my contacts or the things that I aspired to do were still at the residence that I had shared with a friend, a lady that I was in a relationship with.
Yeah.
And I picked that up, I dusted it off, and I began to read my own words, mm-hmm. and the light turned back on. The mm-hmm. passion started to build up again. And I had a wonderful stretch of 5 years of abstinence from drugs and alcohol and commitment to community and educational mm-hmm. pursuits and all of these wonderful things until I hit another spot where I was in a new place with new challenges that I didn't know how to quite navigate
mm-hmm.
and didn't know how to talk about it with others, was struggling for the words and found myself again relapsing and trying to regroup from that. And so it's been like that probably for the last 5 years, you know,
mm-hmm.
bouncing from one emotional state to another, trying to figure out how to maintain my sobriety. So these last 5 years have been a quest for me to really embrace what recovery means for me, for Robert.
Right.
Not what the people at the program tell me it means, mm-hmm. not what the people in prison told me it meant, not what the parole right. officer tells me it means, but what does it mean in my heart?
Right.
Because at the end of the day, if I don't stay sober, mm-hmm. if I don't can maintain a healthy life style,
mm-hmm.
I'll go back to prison because drugs and alcohol has always equaled incarceration for me.
Right. Me too. And so, were you ever offered any type of rehabilitative programs or services within or upon release of the state jail or prison?
Now, that's a very difficult question to answer because when you say rehabilitative, you need to qualify that. Because
right.
what does that mean? I mean, I know what the word means.
Right.
But when you're talking about, that's subjective.
Right.
Because changes, I mean, they told me to take changes before I got out.
Yeah.
But that was like going into a kindergarten class.
It was.
I mean, everybody was disrespecting the instructor, throwing paper balls. I mean, I did receive some information from that instructor that I thought was important, but it was against the odds.
Mm-hmm.
It was over the noise, the clatter. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, if you call that rehabilitative, that's sad.
Right.
Because it was not even 6 months before I was released. I mean, I'm rushing this information into my spirit.
Hmm.
I'm trying to grab a hold of what it means. You telling me the bank account? I can have multiple bank accounts and that I need to save money? I haven't had money in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're throwing ideas at me that it's like throwing wet paper onto a wall. Some of it's going to stick. And a lot of it's going to just ooze down until it falls to the floor.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, what does rehabilitation mean? Because I think it means something different for those of us that are in the system than it does for those that create these programs. I think sometimes they mean well by creating these programs. I went to a treatment program. I went to the IPTC. Now, I'll tell you, that was helpful. Mm-hmm. On one level. But the problem was you're sending a lot of people there that have no desire to be there.
Mm-hmm.
The parole board says FI6. So that means you have to spend 6 months in an IPTC, an in-prison therapeutic community.
Mm-hmm.
And therapy means that you're going to receive some healing. Well, I'll tell you, it was challenging because if you really were there to work on yourself, you were going to be ridiculed. You were going to be scorned. You were going to be isolated. Because the first thing everybody tells you before you even go there, you're going to a snitch program. And that's exactly how a lot of folk characterize SafeP and IPTC.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned, it wasn't, they weren't teaching anybody to snitch.
Mm-hmm.
They were teaching us to see that we were a part of a community. And if we're going to be a part of a community, we have to regard our boundaries and the boundaries of others. We have to acknowledge space for other people to exist in this world. There are rules mm-hmm. that facilitate our interactions. So they would tell us rules are meant to be followed. So, you know, you got written up if you slid a chair across the floor. That was a rule, no sliding chairs. Well, the guys in prison thought that was the most ludicrous thing, but to me, I saw the wisdom of it because what they're trying to show me is if you can obey and be mindful in this small matter,
mm-hmm.
how much easier would it be to do it in the bigger matters outside?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I interpreted it. But that kind of interpretation caused me to be, I mean, I probably was one of the few, if only, persons who had that way of looking at things
mm-hmm.
because most guys in there just, you know, balked at it because they thought, you know, okay, I've got to write this guy because I saw him slide the chair across the floor. What sense does that make? Mm-hmm. I understand that might sound trivial, but what I saw from that was this. In this life, we're going to have things that happen that we're going to see. We're going to have a choice to make. Do we ignore it? Or do we...
Which is a choice.
I was at a restaurant the other day and I saw two people arguing outside. Obviously, one gentleman may have been out of sorts, drinking of something or something. And the other person, I don't know his circumstance, but he was patronizing the restaurant. But the guy outside made some loud noises about hurting him. What do I do? Do I sit there and let it go down? Well, what if the guy pulls out a gun and starts shooting? Now I had a choice to make. So I decided to call 911. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to give my name. But I still want to tell you that something's going on. I'd like for you to at least come over here and take a look into this.
Sure.
I learned that there. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is, if I ignored that, somebody got hurt, wouldn't I be part to blame? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't I have some culpability in that?
Right.
So, you know, this is what it means to be a part of society, to be a part of community, to me. Mm-hmm. And that's what I learned there. So there was some rehabilitative value to that experience for me. Although the challenge was I had to do it in the midst of massive opposition.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if you could tell decision makers or legislators something about your lived experiences regarding state jail, what would it be, or state prison?
If I could tell them anything, I would tell them to listen to people's stories. Yeah. I would tell them to take time to know who this person is that you're about to judge or create a rule to circumscribe the existence of. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't study as much as you can what you're about to legislate on or to create a harsh penalty for, if you don't build into that process a means by which to capture their story, to know the path that a person's had to walk, that's gotten them to the place at the end where they're now being judged, I think you're going to be destroying a lot of lives. I think you're going to be creating a lot of anger. And I think you're going to be ruining our futures. Because no choice is performed in a vacuum. What you do is going to have a ripple effect on the world around you. You and that choice that you make, that decision you make. That's what I would say.
Right.
I would also say, you know, what's important to me is I think segregation in prison is archaic. Mm-hmm. And we need to truly minimize the use of it. And we know we don't under any circumstances need to use it for mental health patients.
Right.
How can you expect somebody that's already paranoid and schizophrenic to function mm-hmm. adequately when you lock them up for 20 hours a day, whatever it may be, give him no human contact. He's hearing nothing but shouts and screams and yells of terror from everyone else down the run. How do you expect that person to function?
Right.
And then you have a system called special needs parole that this person should be eligible for if they have a sickness or an illness. But how can they get better to qualify? If you create an environment where there's nothing but hostility and anger, and maybe that won't come across as clearly as I want it to because I'm speaking about my brother now. Mm-hmm. He's been incarcerated for 15 years and he's a mental health patient and he's been in segregation for most of it.
Wow, that's heartbreaking.
Truly, I can't even summon the strength right now to write him because I don't want to hear back from him because I don't want to feel the feelings that I feel.
Right.
I'm afraid one day I'm going to hear that he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just tell him just to see that we are human beings, mm-hmm. that we are human beings. We are people. We are brothers. We are sisters. We are cousins. We are children of somebody. We're people just like you.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was your son, your daughter, mm-hmm. how would your rule you're about to make affect the life of someone you loved? Right. That should be your litmus test.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.